Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 331 on Friday, December 5th, 2014. Greetings from Cambridge, Massachusetts, where Darlene and I are in the final weeks of our East Coast half of our migratory year. We will return to Denver the day after Christmas and remain based there pretty much until June, though I expect we'll be making frequent trips back here to stay in touch with my family. My interview guest this week is in Vancouver, British Columbia, Peter Hudson, co-founder and CEO of BitLit. That is a startup built around an intriguing way to purchase a low-cost ebook for which you already have a print version of the book. Because the mix of ebooks to print has a big impact on his business, Peter Hudson has some interesting views from his watching of trends in ebook adoption.
We do continue to see growth amongst more of the older generation, more of the boomer generation, around font size and the convenience. As boomers retire, they do more traveling. They want to, you know, travel light, downsizing of houses, want simplification in your life.
It's becoming less of a shock to hear my generation called as the older generation. In our mind, boomer meant youth, but when you get into your 60s, and depending on who you're talking to, that you just have to accept that those are the facts. But in any event, I think it was a good indication of why people of my age or in the 60s and up do seem to gravitate toward ebooks in a way that probably explains some of the passion people feel for this podcast and my joy in doing it. First up in news, the topic of Amazon's profits or lack of them has received considerable attention recently, what with earnings reports showing big losses and future losses being predicted. One sobering development for shareholders was an announcement by Moody's Investors Service that it was changing its outlook for Amazon.com from stable to negative. It came the same day that Amazon announced it was issuing new senior unsecured notes as a form of debt to be used for general corporate purposes in support of growth initiatives. Quote, "It is Moody's expectation that the funds will not be utilized for any form of shareholder returns," the service said in its release. However, it affirmed its previous rating of Amazon's debt at Baa1 because of what Moody's called, quote, "Amazon's excellent liquidity." Amazon stock price dropped by more than 3% the following day, and the slide has continued since then for a close today, Friday, at $312.63 a share, and that represents a decline of 7.6% since the Moody's announcement. I came across a video clip posted today at Business Insider, and in it, Jeff Bezos is asked about Amazon's profitability by Business Insider editor and CEO Henry Blodgett at a conference that I think was hosted by Business Insider. Bezos, you may know, is an investor in Business Insider, and that might explain what I thought was kind of an awkwardness in Blodgett's tough questioning, which began by noting Amazon's lack of profits lately, after which he asked Bezos once and for all if Amazon can make money. Bezos responded lightheartedly, "This is Henry's version of being nice to me." They were both sitting on purple couches, kitty-corner to each other, and there was a little banter back and forth, and when the famous laugh subsided, Amazon's founder presented an explanation of his business strategy in a fairly fresh way, I thought. In this clip that I'm going to play for you, Blodgett asks two follow-up questions, and the exchanges end up giving a pretty clear sense of just how bothered Bezos is by Amazon's big net losses. This clip is just under 3 minutes, and I'll play it for you uninterrupted. You'll find a link to the video and a little bit more than what I'm playing here at thekindlechronicles.com.
The reality is that Amazon is a collection of several businesses and initiatives. And we have some very significant, very profitable, more established businesses that are free cash flow generating very significantly. And then fortunately, the way I think about it, we have lots of opportunities to invest in new initiatives, and we take advantage of those opportunities. So it's kind of like we built this lemonade stand, you know, 20 years ago. The lemonade stand has become very profitable over time. But we also decided to use our skills and the assets that we've acquired over time to open a hamburger stand and a hot dog stand and so on and so on. So we're investing in new initiatives.
And this is certainly what your investors who've been with you for a long time fervently believe. And you ask them, like, why doesn't it bother you the way it bothers some people that the company's not profitable and has an infinite PE and all
this stuff? Look, you know, Warren Buffett has this great quote. He says, you can hold a rock concert, and that's okay. And you can hold a ballet, and that's okay. Just don't hold a rock concert and advertise it as a ballet. Investors come in all shapes and sizes. They have different investment horizons, different approaches, different beliefs about what the right kind of portfolio looks like. And so it's not one, you know, people use Wall Street as a shorthand, but there isn't one type of investor. They come in all shapes and sizes. And you have to be super clear about what kind of company you're trying to build, what your approach is. We laid that out in our 1997 annual shareholder letter. We said we were going to take big bets. We said they were going to fail. We said some of them hopefully were going to work. We said we were going to invest for the long term, that we were going to try to take advantage of market opportunities as they arose. And there's a certain kind of investor who is aligned with that approach. And so, again, you can hold the ballet or the rock concert, and both can work. Just be clear about which one you are, and then people can self-select.
And so lots of CEOs, I'm sure, would like to learn from you, how is it that I can not be at all profitable and still have an incredibly high stock price on, by some measures? What is your advice? Is it spend many years explaining we're never going to earn a penny because we're going to be reinvesting it?
I would say, you know, it's very difficult for a publicly traded company to switch. So if you've been holding a rock concert and then you want to have a ballet, that transition is going to be difficult. But if you've done it from the very beginning, and then I think it's not that difficult to do.
I suppose Amazon, by that analogy, is more rock concert than ballet. Interesting analysis based on Warren Buffett. So there you have it, reading the body language. I didn't see a guy who looked worried in this interview, and we know for a fact that Amazon has been in more perilous straits earlier in its 20-year history than it is now. His reference to the Warren Buffett quote makes me remember that my decision to buy Amazon stock was based on a long time horizon, so I don't waste much time checking in to see how the current price compares with when I bought it, I think a couple of years ago or so. And meanwhile, I love the products and the services and the continuous innovation and the customer obsession which this particular lemonade stand seems to continue to put on offer. Amazon on December 1st announced that its Black Friday sales of Kindle e-readers and Fire tablets on Amazon grew significantly year over year. Fire tablet sales were up more than three times this Black Friday compared with last year, and Kindle e-reader sales soared to four times the 2013 level. I think that shows the success of the Voyage in particular, but also the new entry-level $79 Kindle I suspect is selling pretty well in addition to that. The devices have seen some significant price discounts in recent weeks, so if you're in the market for one in the coming weeks, keep an eye on special offers. And if you start your checking on the offers by clicking on an Amazon ad at thekindlechronicles.com, that's the show notes page for the podcast, any purchase that you make, I think within 24 hours of landing on the Amazon page, any purchase will generate some benefit to the Kindle Chronicles with Amazon Associates commissions, and that's much appreciated as a way to help meet the hosting costs and other expenses of the podcast. For this week's tech tip, I want to pass along a great suggestion from Carol in Davis, California. She writes, "Every week I look forward to hearing your Kindle tips and listening to your guest interviews. I have a Kindle Fire HD and a Kindle keyboard, and I'm looking forward to getting the new Kindle Voyage for Christmas. While reading customer reviews on Amazon about the new Kindle Voyage, I came across this tip about downloading Project Gutenberg books directly to your Kindle device. there is a way to easily download public domain books from Project Gutenberg on your Kindle by using the experimental browser. And you open that browser from the home screen of your Kindle. It's in the main menu. And once you're there, you type in the following web address or URL, freekindlebooks.org. You can put www dot in front of that, but when I tried it, all I had to do was enter freekindlebooks.org. This will open a link to what's referred to as the Magic Catalog on your website, and when you download that catalog, it will appear on the homepage of your Kindle. You'll see it as a listing of all the books in Project Gutenberg and the books are linked to their website. So you can search for something like, say, Peter Pan, download it from the catalog right onto your device without having to connect to a computer. Very nifty. This can be done on any Kindle, not just the Voyage. Carol writes, maybe you are already familiar with this, but I thought I'd pass it along to you anyway. It worked fine on my Kindle keyboard. I speedily downloaded Dickens's A Christmas Carol without a hitch. So I think there was a version of this that I was aware of a year or two ago, but it seems more streamlined. I tried it on my Voyage just following these directions that Carol passed along, and it worked like a charm. I am connected to Wi-Fi here at the house, so the experimental browser found freekindlebooks.org easily. The Magic Catalog link was there on the first page of that website, and the download took just a few moments. I had to switch to all items view from collections on the home screen of my Voyage in order to see the download appear on the home screen. There, the title that was on the list of books was The Magic Catalog of Project Gutenberg eBooks. When I opened the catalog, I found thousands of titles, and I was also glad that I have page press buttons on the Voyage, because every page in this view is filled with live links, and that means it's a little more convenient to advance to the next page without tapping on the screen. You're just pressing that side bar on the Voyage, because that way you're not inadvertently tapping on a link when what you want to do is advance the page. When I searched for Mark Twain on my Voyage using the magnifying glass on the menu bar at the top of my screen when I was within the catalog, I received a message saying title not yet indexed. So I think it takes a while for the Voyage to digest this large file in order to navigate it with the search function. I did see a Mark Twain book that happened to be on the first few pages of the catalog, and when I tapped on it, my experimental browser opened up asking if I wanted to download a file named g70.mobi. I tapped OK, received a confirmation message in a few moments, and when I returned to the home screen, there it was, What is Man and Other Essays by Mark Twain. This is really handy. It's a good tool to make sure anyone on your holiday list knows about if they're receiving their first Kindle or maybe a new Kindle. It works in some ways even a little better on the Fire HD 6, which was able to index the Magic Catalog in just a few seconds, and it presented an orange progress bar as it did so. So that part of it just happened faster than on the Voyage. I was able to search for Mark Twain, and I found 164 titles by him. I downloaded A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court and found it on the Documents section of the media content on the Fire HD 6. This is a part which I think is a little less handy on the Fire, because the title that shows up from this download is not A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court the way I think it would show up on the home page of the Kindle Voyage. It was PG86, so I had to sort of know that that's the one that I had downloaded. There's probably a way to change that using a tool like Calibre. But in any event, the price is right, and the selection is wonderfully vast, courtesy of the volunteers and visionaries that make Project Gutenberg possible. I want to thank Carol for this tip. If you have a tip that you think other listeners would find helpful, I hope you'll email it to me at podchronicles@gmail.com. Time now for the interview. Last week, I tried the innovative BitLit procedure for scanning a physical book in my library and then purchasing its ebook equivalent for a discounted price. So I was glad that I was able to connect with the company's co-founder and CEO, Peter Hudson, for this week's interview. Pete is a serial entrepreneur who started his first company when he was 14 years old. He co-founded BitLit in June of 2012 after seeing the potential of creating a new way for the owner of a paper book to also acquire the title as an ebook. To get publishers on board, they designed a kind of an ingenious procedure for proving ownership of the print book by having the owner simply write his or her name on the copyright page in ink and photograph it with an iOS or Android device. By creating social digital rights management this way for print, BitLit has inked agreements covering 80,000 books in its system. I reached Pete by Skype on Tuesday, December 2nd at BitLit's offices in Vancouver, British Columbia, and I began by asking him to describe how a Kindle owner might use BitLit.
The way you'd use BitLit is actually not on your Kindle to start. You'd start on your smartphone. So you download the BitLit app for either your iPhone or your Android device.
And you can also use an iPad, right?
I think you can get it loaded onto an iPad. Technically, we actually don't like it to be on the iPads because they don't have great cameras. And we'll get to why having an good camera is important in a second.
Okay.
But the process, sort of, you download it onto your smartphone or your tablet. And then the process works like this. The first thing you're asked to do once you get into the app is to take what's called a shelfie. So obviously we make deals with publishers to kind of get this bundle ebook available, but it's still a reasonably small number of publishers in the grand scheme of things. And I just checked this morning, we've got 220 publishers on board. It's getting up to about 80,000 titles now. But still, that's a reasonably small fraction. That's about 4% of the books on the average bookshelf. So we estimate there are about 2 million books that sell in any meaningful quantity. Obviously, that's highly variable if you account J.K. Rowling. Seven of her books sell in quite a lot of quantity. Nonetheless, the way the system works is you take this shelfie, which is just a photograph of your bookshelf. Just line your camera up with your bookshelf, use the guidelines on screen, and take some photographs. And you know, you probably get about 20 or 30 books into each one of the pictures. And our technology is able to actually read the book spines. So we can identify every book in your frame, regardless of whether it's in the database or not. We can give you an exhaustive inventory of all your print books in your collection. And then based on that, we give you both the full list and a short list of the books that are eligible. So a book that is eligible could either be a book that's free as in speech. It's out of copyright. We can just give you the ebook copy of it. So this is pretty much any book that's sort of 75 years older or more. Or we've got books that are what we call free as in beer. These are books where the publisher has said, hey, if you own the physical copy of this book, we will give you the ebook for free. All you've got to do is the next step, which we'll get to. And then there are books where the publisher is charging a small upgrade fee. And that is typically about 10% of the print book cost, which is usually about 20% of what the ebook would cost. So you're getting a substantial discount on what you would pay if you wanted to get the Kindle edition of this book. And so once you've done this shelfie and it's processed and you get the short list, you obviously get all the books that are free as in speech. And if you want to claim any of the books that are free as in beer, or the ones that are heavily discounted, the process involves, again, that writing of your name on the copyright page and taking a photo. So that's what we call, I think, claiming a book. And to claim a book, it's two photographs. The first is a cover shot. We want to know that you have the right edition of that book. So that's where we take cover art into account. And then open the book to the copyright page and you write your name in your best kind of grade 3 printing across in a nice open white space on the copyright page. And then you kind of hold it out and take a photo of that. And yeah, we've got automated algorithms that will read all of that stuff. And within a few seconds, you should have an email in your inbox with the download links to the ebook. And we'll typically provide all the formats. So we'll give you the PDF, the Mobi, and the EPUB. So for Kindle users, obviously they're very familiar with the Mobi, because that's the format that's compatible with their devices. So you get all the formats.
And the payment goes through it would charge however you're paying for your iTunes purchases?
Exactly. So if the book is free, obviously it's free. If the book is not free, then we're obviously not asking for your credit card number. It's going through iTunes or Google Play if you're an Android user.
Oh, okay. So if you're going in by Google, it would hit Google Play instead of iTunes.
It hits Google Play instead of iTunes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You don't have any of the big five publishers participating yet, is that right?
We do, in fact. So we have HarperCollins on board. Now, HarperCollins is on board for a reasonably small set of titles. Uh-huh. They piloted with us over the summer for 7 titles. We had some Neal Stephenson. He put in Cryptonomicon. We had Joe Hill put in Heart-Shaped Box. He actually put in Heart-Shaped Box for free. Kudos to him. So we... and he was very supportive of what we were doing. We had a few others titles that came in. So we're actively talking to HarperCollins about expanding that pilot, because obviously they're part of Matchbook, and they are also offering bundling through their own website.
Well, let's talk about Matchbook. That's the Amazon program, and it searches all of your physical purchases back to, I think, 1995 at the start of Amazon, and enables you to purchase ebook versions of it for $2.99 or less. How do you compare what Bitlet is doing versus Matchbook?
I think they're very similar in the sense Amazon is uniquely positioned among book retailers in the sense that it sells both print and digital. So, and not only does it sell both print and digital, it sells print exclusively through a billing record system that is exhaustive. If you go into Barnes & Noble, if you went into Borders, or if you're up here in Canada, and you went into Chapters or Duffy's when it still existed, and you bought a book, if you bought that book, even with a credit card, it's likely that there's no billing record unless you have a loyalty card. You've got a Barnes & Noble card, or if you've got a Waterstones card in the UK, or Chapters card. So most of the books, in fact, 90%+ of physical book sales that didn't go through something like Amazon have no billing record. This is also true for books that you receive as gifts. This is especially true for what's called the male reader. Somebody who's, you know, they get the Father's Day books. They like the biographies, the Chris Hadfield kind of books. The biographies, the histories, those kind of things. Those books tend to be bought by somebody else and given as gifts to somebody. So that's a case where you have somebody who may not be the purchaser who actually ends up as the consumer of the book or the reader of the book. And that's where I think we complement the Matchbook solution, in that the Bitlet system works for books regardless of where they were purchased, when they were purchased, whether they were given as gifts, even if you bought them secondhand. It doesn't matter where the book actually was acquired, as long as you own the physical copy. The other thing, of course, is that it, for obviously not so applicable to your listeners, but for anyone who doesn't own a Kindle or doesn't shop exclusively on Amazon, Bitlet is also a solution.
Mm-hmm. If I bought a book on Amazon and I gave it to somebody, the Matchbook system is going to let me purchase that ebook for myself, but there's no way for that to get tracked to the person who I gave the book to, right?
That is correct, although I believe if you had that book shipped to somebody through Amazon as a gift, so I think if you noted that it was a gift purchase, then it's not included in your Matchbook list.
Oh, interesting.
I believe that's one of the exclusions of it.
One of the things that I'm sure is going to affect the future of what you're doing is the mix of how people are reading. How many people are reading strictly print books, strictly e-books, some kind of a hybrid. I would think that your market is kind of by definition limited to people who are comfortable reading in either format. Is that the case?
Yeah, the hybrid reader is something that's come up recently. And what's interesting about the way the ebook reading ecosystem has evolved, and it's so often that we draw parallels to the music industry. In fact, I did right at the beginning of this interview. But it's different in significant ways, in the sense that 9 years after the iPod had launched, nobody was buying CDs anymore. Everyone was buying MP3s or the equivalent through iTunes. Now, we're in the equivalent length of time after e-readers have made a significant impact on the ecosystem. And yet, the latest numbers from Nielsen are that 96% of readers are still reading in a hybrid mode. Only 4% of people have gone ebook only. Now, there was a recent number that came out that said that was 8%. So you'd have to probably go to someone like Nielsen to get the actual numbers. But it does show that the transition from print to digital is different in this case. And I think there are reasons for that, and I can throw up a few anecdotal sort of examples of how it's different for me. The experience of reading a book, and I'm a tablet reader. I don't have a bespoke e-ink device. The experience on a tablet is quite different than reading on paper, in the sense that reading is an immersive experience. You need to get your mind into the narrative. You need to construct quite a complicated mental image of the story of where you are. And if you have your Twitter feed holding over the top of the screen every 20 seconds, every minute and a half, it's going to break that experience for you. Now, I'm sure there are ways to sort of switch all that stuff off and go into a do not disturb mode, but that's an entirely different experience than picking up a paper book where you don't have to do any of that. It just works. It's naturally immersive. So I think for things like narrative fiction, there is going to be the case for both. Now, I can absolutely see this in the case for the hybrid reader around things like professional books or narrative nonfiction, where you want to have both formats. You want to have an enhanced ebook, say for a medical textbook. You want to have an animation of the heart beating. But at the same time, if you're studying and you have three textbooks, I know certainly when I was a student, I used to study from three textbooks at the same time. That's 6 pages worth of content out on my desk. I would need 6 iPads to get the equivalent of desktop real estate to make that work. I think there is going to be the case for owning both.
I think it's really surprising to me that the number of people only reading ebooks is as low as 4 or 8%, because I'm trying to picture what that looks like. If I buy a novel, as you say, narrative fiction, where I'm relying on the text, and I prefer reading it as a book, I guess there's the use case for switching to ebook is mainly about travel, right? If I then head to the subway or I'm on a plane, or are there other?
There's that. There are a few others. There's the case of sort of more of the baby boomer, the zoomer generation, being able to increase the font size.
Okay, but if that's the case, if they want the font size increased, why would they spend any time reading the print book, because the font size can't be changed and it's sort of by definition too small?
I agree, and I think that's probably the case for many people who, and perhaps one of the reasons why the boomer generation has adopted e-readers in the way that they have. If you do read narrative fiction and you want the features like tap to define and increase font size and, you know, glow in the dark so that you can read with your partner in bed and not have a light on, all those sorts of features really lend themselves towards an ebook only experience. But what it doesn't lend itself to is, for example, if you have, say, a copy of a book on your shelf that you love rereading, or let's say you have a copy of a book on your shelf that you haven't read, and I'm certainly guilty of this. In fact, there's a Japanese word for it. It's so prolific there, called sundoku, is the art of buying a book and then not reading it, having it pile up. So this is a huge thing. Lots of people, in fact, buy books and then don't read them.
I think it's even worse on a Kindle. I have e-sundoku with, I think I've got over 100 books that I bought, you know, special deal, $1.99 for Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. How can I afford not to have that in my e-library? But it's now just grown to kind of a problem that I have hundreds of books that I don't know if I'll live long enough to read them all.
Yeah, so it is that case. And I mean, I think for the physical bookshelf, there's exactly the same thing. You know, you're gifted a great biography or a history that you really want to read. And, you know, you're a traveler or you prefer to read on an e-reader.
The benefit of the physical books that you don't read, at least they serve the purpose of showing that you're, you know, a smart person who has an impressive library. But if they are languishing in the cloud, who even knows, you know?
Who even knows? I mean, if you're going to read Tolstoy, if you're going to buy a copy of Tolstoy, you know, you want it in a physical copy, so at least if you don't read it, you can have it on your mantelpiece. Whereas if you want 50 Shades of Grey, it's probably better to get that one as an ebook, the kind of book that everyone wants to read, but no one really wants to own.
Well, you must have thought ahead or tried to consult various surveys as to what, say, 5 or 10 years from now, does the mix of print and ebook reading change? There's some indication that the growth certainly has plateaued in the last couple of years, but what did you sort of base your hopes for success for BitLit on in terms of how you expect the mix of book reading to be in the future?
I think the mix of book reading is going to continue to change towards digital. I don't think it's going to go there exclusively. We've certainly seen an end to the triple digit year-on-year growth in the mature markets. These would be Japan, Canada, UK, US. And we're seeing the same sort of rapid adoption in various secondary markets like Germany, where as the content comes on board, you have rapid adoption of e-readers, and it tends to plateau at around 40%, and then you get into single-digit growth. And what we see is that tends to be, I even have a name for this person, this kind of caricature, is the book maven. And this is generally a woman, professionally educated, professionally employed, lives in a suburb, high disposable income, commutes to work on public transit, reads fiction, mostly romance. And this is the caricature of the person who reads a lot of ebooks. And we do continue to see growth amongst more of the older generation, more of the boomer generation, around font size and the convenience. As boomers retire, they do more traveling. They want to, you know, travel light, downsizing of houses, want simplification in your life. But what is very interesting, I think, entirely underreported in the book media, is that the only demographic among which e-reading is in fact ticking down is millennials. So the latest two Nielsen studies have shown...
Now, millennials, remind me again what years the millennials are born.
I would say the millennials are 1980s and 1990s.
Okay.
So came of consumer age within the first decade of the millennium.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the demographic, the only demographic that is in fact ticking away from e-books. The adoption has actually decreased. So you're seeing people abandon the e-reader and return to print.
What do you think is going on there?
I'm not entirely sure what is going on here. And this would be something that only someone at Nielsen would be able to sort of dig into with the original raw data. But it's incredibly telling that the only demographic is the one that you think should be a digital native and should be the most adopting of this new technology is in fact shunning it and pushing it away. Now, it could be because that's an anomaly in the data. It's a small data set, not a data guy, so I'd want to know the error bars and the chi-square distributions on all of that, but Nielsen didn't give us any of that.
You know, it seems to me that in that group, thinking of them, and also people that prefer the immersion experience undistracted by Twitter and the email, is that the e-ink readers are as close to the print book. They're closer to the print book than they are to tablets because of that. It's difficult. You can check your email and do things, but it's so tedious that I think very few people ever use their e-ink Kindles or other e-readers for anything other than reading a book. And I would think that if someone is staring at a computer screen all day and they have that desire to read something and not have it feel like their work environment, that the Kindle would be just as satisfying an alternative as a print book. But do you think that's just something people don't realize, or that there really is something that much different about the book because you can smell it and all the things you usually hear about?
Yeah, you hear about the nostalgia of smelling a book and all that sort of thing. There's even a perfume that came out recently, the book smell. I'm not sure.
I hadn't heard about that. There's a perfume of book smell.
There's a perfume or a cologne that's, you know, old book smell. I'm not sure that'll be my cup of tea. But getting to the idea of the e-ink reader sort of being a more pure reading experience, I agree. I think absolutely for things like narrative fiction, there is as close as you can get to paper would be an e-ink device. Now, what is interesting, though, is that for a younger generation, sort of a recently coming of professional income generation or a student budget, they may not be able to dispose of or sort of be able to handle the cost of a bespoke device, mm-hmm. a bespoke e-ink device. And that may be something that's more of a discretionary spend for someone in the boomer generation.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, let's talk a little bit about digital rights management. The copy of the book that I got from PM Press, it looks like there's no DRM on it. Can you say roughly how many of the books in your system now, the 80,000 or so, get delivered without DRM versus some way to try to control what the buyer does with their copy of the book?
Sure, absolutely. So the overwhelming majority of our titles are DRM-free. Mm. So this would be 80, 90% plus. It's the exception that proves the rule. We do have some publishers that use watermarking, so social DRM, but the overwhelming majority are DRM-free.
Well, that means you convince a lot of publishers to go DRM-free, which is certainly better for users, and I think it would help the market. Why were they willing to do that when kind of in ebooks in general, I mean, Tor and a few others have gone without DRM, but it seems like the mainstream publishers all are buying the idea that DRM is necessary.
I think it may be a function of the fact that we are, in fact, a new business model. So we tend to have publishers who would sign up who are forward thinkers. Mm-hmm. So you have a selection bias in that sense, that the publishers who are more willing to try new business models are also more understanding of the idea that if you put a lock on digital content, it's not there for the consumer's protection. And, you know, a digital lock is, by definition, you can't build a digital lock that cannot be broken. The more valuable the thing you put behind a lock, the faster that lock will be broken.
Exactly. Do you have any improvements to the platform coming down the road, or what's the future look like for BitLit?
The future for us looks like more titles and and just want to get more content onto the platform. We're having exceptionally good conversations now with almost all the big five publishers. So I have fingers crossed that we'll add maybe one or two more of them in the coming year. No promises, of course. We just want to make format shifting a personal paper library into ebook as seamless and as frictionless as possible. And for us, that means just signing up as many publishers as we possibly can.
What about a partnership with Amazon somehow, or being acquired by Amazon? Do you ever think along those terms?
Now, I have met the folks from Amazon. I ran into Russ Grandinetti last year at the Frankfurt Book Fair. It was right after they had launched Kindle Matchbook. And I walked up to him after he had just given his keynote address where he'd announced Matchbook. And his last slide was, in fact, on Matchbook. And he said, you know, this is an incredible program. All publishers should really be part of it. And, you know, I said, Russ, thanks for launching Matchbook. It's an incredible program. Thank you very much for doing so. And he said, oh, that's great. And what do you do? I explained it. And the atmosphere became a little icy. And he said, that sounds like a competition. I don't think that Bitlet had been on his radar at the time. So we'll see how that turns out. But that's a bit of an anecdote. I saw him a day later at the fair, and we got along just well. Just perfectly. So I haven't had any more conversations with Amazon since then.
How would it be competition, though? Because Matchbook is only for books purchased on Amazon. I suppose if somebody had purchased a physical book and they came across Bitlet and did your procedure for getting the bundled ebook, they would be buying the ebook from you as opposed to buying it from Amazon. So it really is a direct competition in that sense.
I guess it could be, although the Matchbook system is fairly frictionless. So yeah, I suppose you could see it as the competition. I'd see it much more as complementary, that we would allow Amazon to bundle books sold anywhere. So it would be increasing the value to the Kindle user of a program like Matchbook. So it would allow Matchbook to work on books that, say, somebody had acquired as gifts or that they bought at a local indie bookstore.
Now, it seems like bookstores should be very supportive of what you're doing, because you're sort of putting the attention back on finding books in physical forms, which would usually happen at a bookstore. Is the American Booksellers or any independent bookstores joining you as partners, or what's your relationships on that front?
The relationships with the bookstores have been very good. In fact, we ran a pilot over the summer with 20 indie bookstores, 13 up here in Canada and 7 in the U.S., where we actually shipped stickers that said, for eligible books, this book includes a free bundled ebook and instructions on how to get it. And what the bookstores said is that they obviously made table displays of these things, is that a book with that sticker on it sells twice as well as the same book displayed in the same way. So for a bookstore and from a bookstore's perspective, it's an incredibly good way to engage somebody who's a digital reader in a physical product. It effectively adds value to the physical product. And if you can pay, you know, your $10 to get the paperback and you get the ebook included for free, well, then you just effectively increase the value of the paperback by doing so. And it's zero incremental cost for the book retailer, and they're putting a sticker on a book. And it's zero incremental cost for the publisher to do so.
Well, but there would be, somebody's paying for the ebook, right?
The ebook would have been, if the ebook is bundled free, then there is no cost. There's no cost for the publishers to participate. If they offer the bundled ebook for free, it's free as in beer for them. And they will have already created the ebook asset, so that would be considered a sunk cost.
That's amazing, though. They sold twice as fast if they had that sticker on it.
It was an amazing result that came back, and it was consistent all across. We were in San Francisco, we were in Brooklyn, we were in Winnipeg, and the results were consistent across all of those bookstores. That sticker was an incredibly powerful way for a publisher to increase the perceived value of the print book.
That shows that a lot of the people in bookstores are hybrid readers, because if they were diehard, you'll never catch me reading an ebook, then the value of the free ebook would be zero.
So it's a way to engage, or it's a way for both the bookseller and the publisher to engage with that hybrid reader.
How big is your operation at this point? How many people are working with you?
The team size right now is fairly small, so we are about 8 full-time, and we're split in between Vancouver and Toronto, although I seem to spend an awful lot of time on planes, flying to places like New York and London.
Reading on your tablet.
Reading on my tablet, yeah.
I have been speaking with Peter Hudson, co-founder and CEO of Bitlet. Thanks very much, Pete.
Thank you, Len.
Time now for your comments, and I really appreciate those of you who have emailed me to say that you've received invitations to purchase an Amazon Echo. It's given kind of a composite view of the device, even though I haven't scored one of the invites myself. I think maybe 5 to 10 listeners of the show have received them, so it's still a pretty small sample, I think, but it is being rolled out. Here's an example from Cindy Brooks, who wrote the following. Len, I was lucky enough to receive an invitation for Echo over the Thanksgiving holiday while visiting my son and grandchildren in Pittsburgh and ordered the minute I got home. Didn't want it delivered before I got there. It arrived yesterday, this is December 2nd, and I got it set up this morning. All I can say is I so hope you are able to get one soon so we can all hear your impressions. I'm having a ball with it, and the Amazon folks are so responsive to any questions or comments. In fact, they are counting on feedback. I feel like a pioneer. One of the interesting things the associate I spoke with told me was that they want Alexa to recognize all kinds of voices and accents, so my mild southern accent is suddenly an asset after a lifetime spent trying to lose it. I remember Cindy's really pleasing way of speaking from the time that I did Google Plus Hangouts, and she used to participate in them. So I'm glad that Alexa and her team are going to benefit from learning how to talk mild southern. Bob McTagg last week wrote that he had received an Echo. His experience has been good for the most part, though he did add the following. It didn't do so well in the sports arena. Like on Friday, I asked, when is today's Celtics basketball game? And when is today's Boston Celtics basketball game? Both to no avail. If I ask Google, this is the Google voice assistant, it replies with the most recent score and the time of the next game. Just now, I asked Alexa if the Patriots won yesterday's game. It didn't understand the question. If you ask Google, it responds, yes, the Patriots beat the Lions 34-9. My guess is that over time, we will see some big improvements as they analyze the questions that people are asking. I think Bob's right on that prediction that Alexa will improve over time, and I think his account also indicates that Amazon was smart to release the product in a more carefully phased rollout, the better to have feedback from real customers shape the improvements to come. A quite a bit more discouraging Echo experience was relayed to me by Bob Withers, who wrote last week, I wanted to get back with you about the Amazon Echo I ordered. It arrived on Friday the 28th. Right out of the box, I began having problems configuring it as it refused to connect to my Wi-Fi network. I tried setting it up with both the Echo app for Android and the Amazon web page on an iPhone. I found both of these methods unsatisfactory. After entering my Wi-Fi configuration, a progress bar would appear on the screen and progress to about 20% and then stop. After about 10 minutes, a message would pop up indicating that a network connection error occurred and I would be taken back to the Wi-Fi setup screen. After trying this about 7 or 8 times, good man, a lot of patience there, the progress bar completed to 100% and the Echo began working normally. I asked Alexa to play music and she complied. I enjoyed listening to the music stream for about an hour, at which point the ring around the top of the Echo turned red, and I was told there was a network failure and I needed to set Wi-Fi up again. I tried doing this 5 or 6 times without success. At this point, I took the Echo into the room where my wireless access point is and set it about a foot away. The Echo immediately connected and started working. I started experimenting and found that the Echo would not maintain a good connection to the network unless it was within a few feet of the access point. Hopefully, the unit I received was defective, and this is not a general problem with the device, but I am returning mine. So he returned it and got a refund for it. I think he's brave to suggest that he might try one in the future, but so far it's been quite disappointing. Eddie Michael says the sound is excellent, the microphones are very sensitive, it's good at selecting music, and he loves being able to ask for NPR podcasts, Radiolab, etc. He rates it only about 50-50 on asking questions. He says, I need to improve on how to phrase the questions. The Wikipedia reference throws me a little, but I am getting better at it. He says, to be honest, I don't think I could give it up now for $99. It was one of the best toys I have purchased in a while, much better than a tablet.
That's a sample of the Alexa research that I'm picking up from you. And if you get an echo and you want to weigh in on pros and cons, it's entertaining for me and informative as I wait to see if maybe I'm going to get one of these invitations myself. That's it for this week. I have a couple of lines out for interview invitations for next week's show, but at this point I don't have a guest definitively scheduled. Music for my podcast is from an original Thelonious Monk composition named Well You Needn't. This version is Ramonk by Eval Monegat on the Variations in Time, a Jazz Perspective CD by Public Transit Recording. This is Len Edgerly in Cambridge, Massachusetts for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.